Hello.
Good morning, this is John Allen, the sound there.
Hello, John, this is Linda Wigington.
Hey, nice to see you. Well, we're hearing you anyhow.
Great.
Ted Lilas.
Hi, Ted.
Yes.
We will be starting in just a few minutes. I expect a bunch of people to hop on fairly quickly. Were you guys sort of in a limbo mode?
Oh, no, I just came in.
Okay, great.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to this. Tuesdays was really interesting. Thank you.
Well, Gary's a great person to kick off this webinar series.
Yeah. I've never done this sort of thing before. It's excellent.
Challenging. It's easier to do this kind of stuff in person. Doing it by phone is not easy. But the issue is we sure have a lot more... a lot less energy invested in getting together.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to put this on speakerphone. Can you, if I put the handset aside, will you be able to hear me?
Yeah, but we're going to be muting you pretty soon, so hearing you won't be an issue, but we definitely can't hear you as well, so if you decide to... talk, you'll want to go back, not on speakerphone, because particularly with
Hello.
A bunch of people on. Hello.
Gary. Larry Weingarten.
Hey, Larry, how are you?
Doing good.
Good.
So, are we all here?
People are coming in pretty slowly today, so we'll be starting and leaving them in the dust, but I'll be starting on the 1000 Ohm Challenge stuff, so... Just one. Well, what time do you have? I have 11:59, but my computer and my cell phone are not synced.
Close enough.
Constance Grisel.
Who is that?
Constance Grisel.
Hi.
Hi. Hello, this is Berlin Newby.
Hi.
Hi, this is Tom Wagner in Palo Alto, California.
Right. Keep introducing yourself. We'll be starting in actually less than 1 minute.
Mike O'Brien, Portland, Oregon.
Hi, Mike. Got your questions?
Hi, Linda. With Focus on Energy.
Hello.
Hi.
Michael Butel, Avalon Builders.
Hello.
Doug Kirk, Plumbers.
Hello, this is Brian Moy, ICF International, out of Fairfax, Virginia.
Right. You might be able to tell from the introductions, we've got about 50% from California. We targeted primarily California, but sent it to a select group of folks from the rest of North America. Actually, well represented by Canadians. But
they might outnumber Californians.
Oh, no. A lot of Californians, and we have over 100 people registered, which is why I am going to mute you as we speak.
It is official start time when you're ready, Linda.
Yep, and I just, well, wait, let me make sure. Somebody, well, I'm pretty sure it is in presentation mode. Thank you for joining the second webinar in this series. We are doing this under the support of the Pennsylvania or Pacific Gas and Electric Company's Energy Training Center and Affordable Comfort. It's a joint venture specifically focused on providing webinars and using webinars as a tool to support deep energy reduction projects as part of the NorCal Collaborative, which is an entity that was formed in Northern California a little over a year ago with a specific goal of getting 40 deep energy reduction 1,000 home challenge projects documented and complete. And yet we felt that the content of these webinars was such that a lot of people would benefit, so we wanted to open it up outside of the California market and PG&E's territory. So we are in terms of conference call logistics, I am controlling the fact that what mode we're in, and we're all, when we're in conference mode or Q&A mode, you will not hear each other's cell phones, each other's dogs, each other's background noise. So we're going to stay in that mode because with a large number of participants, it's absolutely essential that we have a high-quality call that everyone can hear easily. Because of the number of the folks on the call, this is not interactive as much as it would be in a smaller group or face-to-face group. We apologize for that, but we're compensating with other things, like the fact that you guys responded so well with lots of questions after the last webinar, and we organized the questions so we could really, in an organized way, respond to the questions that came up. When we switch to Q&A mode, you need to push *6 to unmute your phone, and then you can be heard. But otherwise, if you say something, you will not be heard. If you have to go off the call, don't hesitate to just turn off your disconnect your phone and then join back in rather than put us on hold. And last time, one or two people were dropped. Don't know why, but just call back in. It does seem to happen occasionally. We welcome feedback. This is, as I said, just the second of what will be a series of webinars with the goal of having nuggets from this posted online as downloadable chunks with the PowerPoint so that it's very easy to capture and to share this information as well. But that's the next step. So the title of this session is High Performance Hot Water on the Path to Deep Energy Reductions. This is the second part. And you'll see the disclaimer. Gary is speaking for himself. He's not speaking on behalf of Pacific Gas and Electric. That's slide two. You should all have all received a link to the webinar and with the downloadable documents. The first document is the one we'll be going through. We did put slide numbers on the sheet, so if you print this out, you can see what slide we're on. Or if you're in the PDF and you're looking at it on screen, the slide number, the page number, will be at the top of your computer. But we'll be prodding Gary to let us know where we are in terms of what page we're on. The learning objectives for this session are to learn from case studies that apply principles and technologies that were discussed in the first webinar, to better understand the advantages of a systems approach and how the interactions work, and to get your questions answered. And when Gary and I spoke several times yesterday, we decided that the case study might not quite happen as a case study for this call in order to really get to and respond to your questions effectively and use this time as well as possible. Anything you want to say, Gary, about objectives?
Nope, let's keep moving.
Okay, so 1,000 Home Challenge is the initiative that ACI is developing. It's currently in its pilot stage. The intent of this initiative is to contribute to transforming housing stock across North America through demonstrating the potential for deep reductions, basically total shift paradigm and action and principles of how we use energy and resources in houses and how houses function to serve our needs. So we define deep energy reductions as a 70 to 90% reduction. Individual homes have their own target, and you do not meet the 1,000 Home Challenge without a year of documented energy use proof. The proof is in the pudding. And that's where we're really looking at the systems that all come together to work together And because we're looking at the actual use, we obviously are including more than just the rated efficiency of equipment, but also behavioral choices, community solutions, renewables. So efficiency is a cornerstone, but these other resources are incredibly important to meeting the goal of the 1,000 Ohm Challenge. We're not dictating that there's any single path. What we are dictating is there's a goal and it's important to meet it and to learn from that experience. So for hot water specifically, if you move on to the next slide, we both have a percent reduction and a absolute reduction. The percent reduction is just a straight 75% reduction from a verified immediately prior energy use. But for the absolute reduction, this is what the absolute reduction is used is for water specifically for water heating. 10 gallons of hot water per person per day at 100% efficiency, with a slightly lower amount of hot water if there's more than three in the household or more than two in the household. There is a temperature climate consideration for colder climates having a higher budget because incoming water temperature will be lower. But that's the basis for the component, the piece that's hot water. We also have with option B, there's a prediction for heating, cooling, everything else as well as hot water, and all that matters is that you come within the total. It's not a use by use. But hot water is often the piece that's ignored or assumed to be insignificant. It becomes very significant, particularly when you have a mild climate or low use. Gary addressed that last time. And an interesting issue for the 1,000 Home Challenge is in many cases we're not just talking about a fix, we're not talking about a modification, we're really talking about totally rethinking the system. So in some ways, the 1,000 Home Challenge provides this neat opportunity in existing homes to apply what you might be doing in new construction, but applying it to existing homes. And in that case, you might be just redoing your entire plumbing system, or you might be using creative solutions such as a community solution. That could mean a community center where there's laundry and hot water and a variety of other things delivered at extremely high efficiency, great heat recovery, great technology, great renewables, but a place that basically 80% of your hot water is used and then the 20% you use at home could be done with something that's not as expensive. So variety of options for meeting the 1,000 Home Challenge. And we'll be doing two webinars, one tomorrow, one the week from tomorrow, Introduction to the 1,000 Home Challenge. But by all means, please, if you're interested in more information, we're looking for case studies now. Send me an email, and I'll send you the information to join one of the upcoming webinars. So with that, we're into the focus of this session, high-performance hot water. It's an incredible pleasure to work with Gary Klein. Gary and ACI go way, way back. He was on our original board of directors and used to work with the California Energy Commission. He has always been a very strategic systems thinker. He's also always been a person to push wherever people are further and to constantly ask questions and try to figure out why things aren't better than they are. So I see Gary as somebody who's not focused on where we are, but instead has a keen focus on where we need to be. And it's been an incredible, I think, blessing for the sake of efficient hot water that Gary got really excited about hot water, about 10 years ago?
A bit more than that, Linda, but yes, certainly by 10 years ago, I was in it for sure.
And since then has been probing into those corners that people typically didn't ask about, distribution issues, all the synergies, and having a tremendous impact, and just being a person who's constantly thinking and learning and open to whatever challenges people throw his way. So with that, Gary, why don't you take off here?
Thank you, Linda. For those of you that don't know me, I got into hot water about 20 years ago, literally, as opposed to figuratively. Somebody called me and asked me how long it took to get hot water at the fixture furthest from the water heater in my home. He was a salesman, so I told him to go pound sand. That was great, except he kept calling back. Well, I was working on space conditioning issues in California, which for residential was the biggest energy load, and since no one was telling me what I ought to work on, I figured I ought to work on the biggest problem, which was space conditioning. Water heating was number two. I wasn't ready to work on it. But when I eventually got around to doing the test to make this guy go away, I found out that I waited 4 gallons and 4 minutes for hot water to arrive. Well, I had a 1 gallon per minute shower head. 4 gallons, 4 minutes, that sounds about right. The problem was that there was less than 2 gallons of not hot water in the pipe when I started the test. And how come it took more than double for the hot water to arrive? If it had been 10, 15, 20% above and beyond the 2 gallons in the pipe, I would not have been concerned. It would have been a non-issue in my mind. But double just seemed wrong, and I've been trying to figure out how to solve that set of problems related to hot water delivery since. One of the things I observed early on is that pipes are a lot like ductwork. They get ignored. They usually don't leak water, but they do leak heat, and we ought to pay a lot of attention to it. So that's what got me started on this journey, and I want you to move to slide 8, please. This is a review. The gallons per day is on the order of 20 gallons per person per day. The 1,000-home challenge says save 75% of that somehow in terms of energy. Well, you might not have to save 75% of the water, but if you don't change the efficiency of your current heating system, you will. So we need to figure out how to reduce the water use and the energy consumption related to the water use in order to meet the 1,000-home challenge. For purposes of our discussion today, we're going to use numbers around $275 to $300 a year for gas customers, $500 to $600 per year for electric customers, for the numbers we will use for our discussion. And remember, you need to proportion these costs to your fuel and water rates. As we discussed the other day, there are 5 things that are involved in the hot water system. I've moved on to slide 9. The water heater, the pipes, the fixtures, fittings, and appliances, the behaviors, and the water running down the drain. Most of our discussion today will be about the physical aspects of the building. Behaviors are your issue. You need to figure out how to control them and manage them. So we're going to cover the fundamental technologies that sit behind the walls and under the floors, but what we need to remember is that the technologies we put in need to be organized in ways that encourage energy and water efficient behaviors as opposed to discourage them. And I think that that's a key strategy for thinking about how to apply technical options as we move forward. Slide 10, typical hot water event. There's a delivery phase, a use phase, and a cool down phase for every hot water event. We're going to, in today's discussion, show how to reduce the time to tap and the volume to hot. That is, improve the delivery phase. We will discuss at least a little bit how to increase the water use efficiency of the things we use hot water for. And finally, we're going to figure out how to keep the pipes hotter longer so that when the time between events is reasonable, in the 10 to 20 minute range, 30 minute range, maybe even 40 minute range, the water in the pipes will still be hot, so when you turn on hot water in the second and third and fourth consecutive events, you will still see hot water very quickly once you turn on the tap. Slide 11. You remember from the other day, what people want is hot water now and never run out in my shower. Hot water now is instantaneousness. In order for that to be true, you need hot water available before the start of each draw. You need the source of hot water close to each fixture or appliance. Both of these must be true in order to have instantaneous hot water. And we're going to discuss how to deliver hot water in under 10 seconds every time you turn on a tap and the implications of that. And remember that point of use is not about the water heater size. It's about the location of the water heater relative to the fixtures that it serves. Never running out of my shower, the continuousness property, is really about not running out in the shower I use to go to work with. People have different expectations for their playtime versus their work time or their getting ready for work time. And so what we want to do is to make sure what people want is they want continuousness in their business, shower, getting ready for school, that sort of thing. In order to make that happen, there are a couple of ways of doing it. One strategy is a really big tank. The other strategy is a big burner, big enough to keep up with one shower. Maybe a couple other things running at the same time if you think that's going to happen. Or perhaps a better strategy is a modest amount of both. We discussed that at some length and the options for doing that the other day. All right, slide 12, key strategies. Again, a reminder. We're going to wring out the wastes. We're going to improve the water efficiency of the uses. We're going to combine water and space heating, and we're going to increase the efficiency of making hot water. Those are the four strategies we're going to implement. We're going to do them ideally in that order because it's the right way to do it. And so the current byword is efficiency first, and I would actually say that it's conservation first and efficiency second, but let's not quibble too much. We really have to reduce the demands if we can, and one of the best things to do if there are wastes that are not necessary to humans and actions that we want to take, such as wasting water while you wait for it to arrive, and utilizing waste heat that's running down the drain, if we could figure out ways to minimize the waste or capture the energy, we'd be way better off at no cost to us, effectively, from the point of view of our perception of hot water service. So let's move on to slide 13. Step one in this process, we're going to improve hot water distribution system. Slide 14. To improve the delivery phase, the first part of the system, you have to reduce the volume of water that's in the pipe, reduce the number of restrictions to flow, increase the flow rate just before you turn on the tap, and insulate the pipe for, it's particularly important for low flow rates and adverse environmental conditions. So let's go over how to do it. The first point on slide 15 that I want to make is that the waste of water above and beyond what's in the pipe goes up as the flow rate goes down. It is not a linear function, at least not obviously. And it grows rather dramatically as flow rates get below a gallon a minute. So as your flow rate in a 3/4-inch pipe is over 4 gallons per minute, you can expect almost a 1-to-1 correspondence between the volume of water that's in the pipe that's not hot coming out before hot water arrives. Let's imagine you have a gallon in the pipe, a gallon and just a little bit will come out. As your flow rate goes down at 3 gallons per minute, 2 gallons per minute, 2 gallons per minute, 30% extra water comes out of the pipe, so a gallon and a third. At a gallon a minute, about 50% extra comes out. At a half a gallon per minute, it roughly doubles the amount of water that was in the pipe before hot water arrives. At a quarter of a gallon per minute, we've not actually measured it in 3/4-inch pipe yet, but I'm going to guess it's going to be at least 400% based on what we're seeing. And so what I want you to remember is it's really about the velocity in feet per second relative to the diameter that tells you what the water waste is going to be. This is above and beyond what's in the pipe. What this tells me is that we really want to minimize the volume in the pipe, particularly as we decrease flow rates, which is part of what we'll talk about in the next step of things. All right, some definitions on slide 16. Again, a reminder. A twig serves one outlet or appliance. A branch serves more than one twig. A trunk serves branches and twigs. A main serves the building. And hot water locations contain one or more hot water outlets, usually some cold ones, too. Think about bathrooms. The toilets generally don't get hot water except if you're in Alaska. I want to cover a key point here under point one. The diameter of the twig should be determined by the flow rate of the outlet or appliance it serves and the pressure drop that will occur in the pipe. It isn't true that that happens right now. What happens now is that for most of us, the diameter of the twig is determined by the code. There are, in fact, two major plumbing codes that are in operation in the United States. Most states have adopted one or the other of these. The most commonly used in the United States is the International Plumbing Code, the less common of the ones that are used widely is the Uniform Plumbing Code. The International Plumbing Code allows the use of 3/8-inch diameter tubes or pipes for certain fixtures, including individual showers, sinks, lavatory sinks and kitchen sinks are in the sinks category here, and refrigerators and toilets. For some reason, I don't understand the toilets because it's got a higher flow rate. But in any event, they do allow it. The Uniform Plumbing Code, the minimum that's allowed in the tables is half-inch diameter pipe, regardless of the flow rate of the fixture. And so that's a distinction between the two codes, and I currently work on both code bodies to help figure out how to change the rules so that it's easier to use smaller diameter pipe when it's appropriate. More on that a bit later. Slide 17. The ideal hot water distribution system has the smallest volume from the source of hot water to the hot water outlet. Sometimes the source is the water heater and sometimes it's a trunk line. The challenge, we discussed this briefly the other day, deliver hot water to every hot water outlet, wasting no more energy than we currently waste and wasting no more than one cup waiting for the hot water to arrive. First, on slide 19, the first question is, in order to implement that, if you want to waste no more than a cup while waiting for the hot water to arrive, what's the maximum amount of water that can be in the pipe that's not usefully hot? And the answer is one cup. And in fact, from what I've just told you a little earlier today, it has to be less than a cup. Physics wins. It takes a bit more than the volume of water that's in the pipe for hot water to get from one end of it to the other. And you can make it real close to a cup, but you've got to expect that it's going to be a bit extra. A good rule of thumb for our discussion is for flow rates that we typically use in the 1 to 3 gallon per minute range, you should assume it's at least a quarter extra. It's probably a bit more than that in some cases, but a quarter is a pretty good extra amount to assume. Slide 20. If you want to waste no more energy than you would have wasted waiting for the hot water to arrive, how much can any alternative consume? No more than was originally wasted. So one of the key questions in figuring out solutions to this problem, to the challenge, is how much energy is actually attached to water running down the drain before the hot water comes? Well, it turns out nobody actually knows the exact answer to that question. I can measure, and some of us have measured, the time it takes and the volume of water that moves through the pipes from the time they start out cold at room temperature until they're hot enough to shower in, for example, say 105. At that point, we know that the hot water's arrived at the fixture. What we don't know is whether you're using it or not. And I would observe that you probably won't let me put cameras in to figure out when you actually get in the shower and start using it. If we can figure that part out, we'd be able to really measure the behavioral waste separately from the structural waste. Structural waste understates the problem, because if people wait a long time for hot water to arrive, they tend to go away, answer emails and check the messages on the phone and go down to the kitchen, make coffee, open up the door for the dog, that sort of stuff. And then they, it's time to go back and take my shower, and steam is billowing out of the shower stall. Well, we know if steam's billowing out, hot water arrived a long time before that. So the behavioral waste can swamp the structural waste, and all that's relatively easy to measure is structural waste. From my point of view, the studies I've done and the interviews I've conducted, structural waste can be anywhere from 10 to 50% of the actual hot water consumption. That's an enormous range. For our purposes, you can assume it's 20 to 25%. Slide 21. The length of pipe that holds 8 ounces or 1 cup of water. Here's a table using, for 3/8 to 1-inch tubes, CTS is copper tube size. It's used in the industry for equivalencies. And there are other pipes and other diameters, but this is the range that we will typically find in residential applications. And for our purposes today, if it comes to it, I will assume that 3/4-inch pipe is 2.5 feet per cup, and half-inch pipe is 5 feet per cup. It's a good, simple number to use for our discussion. Slide 22. The gallons wasted as a function of time and fixture flow rate. This chart we showed, yes, the other day in the class. What I want you to recognize is it's got time from 1 second up to 60 and flow rates up to 10 gallons per minute. Everything that's in green is less than 2 cups, which I'd say is pretty darn good delivery, and everything in red is half gallon or more, which I'd say is pretty darn bad. And so I want to take you and look in slide 23 at cups wasted as a function of time and fixture flow rate. I removed the shading and used an outline here so that the numbers remain more clear. And what I would observe is this. We're looking at flow rates now from 0.25 GPM up to 2.5 GPM and time up to 15 seconds. What I have learned from interviewing thousands of people, over 20,000 so far, about their hot water use, I would say that everyone wants hot water to arrive within 2 to 3 seconds. That's the typical answer I get when I ask groups of people. Mostly people do not have hot water delivery that good. I would also observe that ASPE, the American Society of Plumbing Engineers, says it's acceptable to have hot water delivered within 10 seconds. Well, the time to tap depends on the flow rate. And what really matters is to pay a lot of attention to two considerations. One, where flow rates are already low, such as half gallon per minute lavatory faucets, and two, where the flow rates are likely to change over the next 20, 50, 80 years of operations, because there will be rules or incentives put in place to indicate that we ought to go to lower flow rates. So let's look at slide 24. If you want hot water to be delivered now in 2 to 3 seconds, the bottom left circle, it has 1.1 to 1.6 cups, will come out before hot water is delivered. If you want to be sure that hot water is delivered wasting no more than 1 cup, you have to have less than 1 cup in the pipe, and probably about 0.75 cups, or somewhere around 4 feet of half-inch tubing. That's not very much. Okay? So what we want to pay attention to is that delivering hot water within 1 cup is a really tough challenge. It's not as simple as it sounds. It's buildable, but you have to think pretty hard about how to do it. By the way, I actually think it's much more buildable to assume hot water will show up within 2 cups, but it's possible to build. Now, let's look at the half-gallon per minute case. Let's imagine it's a 2 gallon per minute lavatory faucet in your bathroom. And in 20 to 30 years, when the plumbing will still be in absolutely wonderful, usable condition, and you're not thinking about replacing it or repairing it, someone's going to have a rule that says no more 2 gallon per minute aerators in single-family residential applications. They're going to be half GPM max. And they're going to take all the 2.5s off the market, and they're all going to be half GPMs, and someone's going to make all sorts of interesting things happen, and that's the only choice you're going to have. Okay, you want to do your part, you put them in. The volume of the time until hot water comes is going to increase to at least 10 to 12 seconds. And in fact, based on what I've told you earlier, you could anticipate it's going to double. It's instead of being 10 seconds, it could be 20 seconds, and the volume running down the drain will easily be over 2 cups. It will more than double the volume of waste as well. Well, it's important to pay attention to that, because if you allow, let's go back up to slide 22 with the gallons wasted. If we allow today hot water to be delivered within, say, 15 seconds at 2 gallons per minute, that means there's about a half a gallon of not hot water in the pipe. And if the flow rate goes down to a half gallon per minute, it's going to take a minimum of 1 minute for the hot water to arrive, and more like 2. And people will scream. One of the reasons I pay so much attention to the volume of the water in the twigs is because I want to make sure that our behaviors and our incentive programs as we move forward enable us to have good hot water service regardless of what happens to fixture flow rates. So back to slide 24, the bottom says my point. I want to future-proof the hot water distribution system over its lifetime. On slide 25, there are five possible solutions we have found. I'm going to walk through some of them as we go through today. Let's talk about central core plumbing on slide 26. This is the classic older home, smaller home with a basement, typically water heater roughly in the center of the basement. Hot water distance and volume is really small. The Greenpoint rated rating manual of January this year has defines it as a maximum of 4 cups from the water heater to the fixtures. You need to have R6 insulation on the line from the water heater to the kitchen. That's a California Energy Commission rule that's in the building standards. And the R4 insulation on the remaining hot water pipes is from Greenpoint rated. All right, let's look at slide 27. This is a 1-quart hot water distribution system. We drew a floor plan of a real home, a potentially real home. We didn't actually have someone's home for this, with real dimensions in the kitchens and the bathrooms and we in the laundry room, and we piped the system using a short trunk and a long twig. The short trunk is 1 cup long. It's the vertical riser that comes up out of the water heater. It's 3/4-inch tubing. On it are a bunch of T's. Each of the T's serves a twig. Each twig is 3 cups long. That's the definition of this hot water distribution system. And I will tell you, it's tough to do. We could improve the performance of this system a little bit by moving the water heater a bit over to the right. It would make it a little bit better, but it's not going to change it dramatically. All right. This is the short trunk, long twig. When someone turns on a tap, let's say at the far right, that's a bathroom sink in both bathrooms which are back-to-back, they've got hot water coming through the trunk line. It's primed with hot water, and it pulls hot water down three extra cups to the twig, to the fixture itself. Then they get out, they get done with their sink, and they turn on their shower. It's another 3 cups from the trunk. Go into the kitchen sink on the far left. That would also be 3 cups till hot water arrives. And as long as the trunk is particularly well insulated, you'll have hot water in 25, 30, 40 minutes after you turn on the first tap anywhere on the trunk line, and each twig will have to run the volume of water that's in it out. Now let's look at slide 28. This is the same house piped with a long trunk, short twig, 1-quart distribution system. In this case, the trunk line comes up out of the water heater. It goes over to the right about five more feet, and so it's a 7.5-foot long trunk line, and each of the twigs is 1 cup. That's the definition of this type of system. Now let's imagine that I want hot water in the far bathroom. I draw 1 quart of water through the system plus the extra that has to come out, and I now have hot water primed throughout the entire trunk line and down a branch and a twig in this case, all the way to the last sink. When I want hot water at any of the other fixtures, as long as the trunk line is hot, I only have to draw 1 cup out of the pipe each time I want it. So the point I want to make on these two slides is that even with a 1-quart hot water distribution system, the long trunk short twig will outperform the short trunk long twig case. Slide 28 outperforms slide 27. Why? On all events, when hot water use occurs shortly after one before it, the trunk line will already be hot, and the volume of waste and weight is only in the twigs, and the twigs are shorter. That's why, and this is an important point for thinking about home run systems. That was one of the questions that I know we had from the other day. Home run systems are often thought of as being green and better. And by the way, I don't care whether they're made with PEX or copper or purple cows and sliced green cheese. I don't care what the plumbing material is. It's about the configuration of the piping. Trunks and branches, properly insulated with short twigs, is a much better performing system in virtually all applications. Let's look at an example of one that somebody built. The manifold in this case is coming up right out of the water heater. Each twig has its own line. In this case, 3/8 inch tubing was allowed for use. They had to go through special calculations to enable its use here in California, but the calculations were approved by the plumbing officials, and they were able to build this system. Eventually, all the piping will be insulated for the hot water side, and it will go up to the fixtures. The longest run in this particular application is 1 quart to the hot, to the furthest fixture. This is the type of system we're talking about. This is a home run system. It's not my ideal, but I have to tell you, it ain't bad. All right, slide 30, structured plumbing. We're going to discuss structured plumbing because in most applications, it is a way to improve upon trunks, branch, and twig configurations and make them work more effectively with less water waste and less time waste. Slide 31. This is a structured plumbing layout showing a dedicated return line. By that I mean a pipe going from the last fixture back to the water heater. You'll note that there are two locations where the pump and controls could be located. If you put the pump near the water heater, you ideally want to put a temperature sensor on the trunk line right after the last fixture on the supply side so that you can, in fact, have the pump turn off when hot water gets there. The activation mechanisms are shown in each of the hot water locations, not the two that are closest to the water heater. Those do not make sense necessarily to put in an activation mechanism because you're trying to trade off priming the line with hot water with running a little bit down the drain while you wait. And I think that the trade-off is appropriate as to where I put the activation mechanisms. Structured plumbing layouts using the cold water line as the return is what we would typically see used in retrofit applications. To me, retrofit means that you are not going to mess with the pipes. If you have torn the building open so that you've got essentially open studs and you can see everything and you're working between the floors and between the walls, I would say that major renovation job is really a new construction application for the plumbing, and it's time to think about moving things. At a minimum, moving the piping, maybe even moving the hot water rooms to make an overall better, more effective plan. In this case, the pump is put under a sink at the farthest end of the system, and you turn on the pump using activation mechanisms, again, in the rooms that are relatively far from the source of hot water and on the same trunk line. So, a short aside, I think that it's important for everyone to look at the exercise which we've given you to do and try it, because that will help tell you where your trunks, branches, and twigs are. You want to know what's on the same trunk line. All right, slide 33.
Jerry, one quick question. To make this work, though, what you're doing is you're not adding this whole return line, are you? You're talking about this working for existing plumbing. Please explain how you'd actually do this in an existing home.
You would install the pump under the sink at the furthest end of the trunk line, and you would basically, there's a kit that comes with the pumps, and you would hook the kit in, get electricity to the pump, and whenever you want hot water, you would quote-unquote tell the pump to come on. Pressing a button or a wireless button would be the optimum cases to use in single-family retrofit. Personally, I'm fond of a wireless button at the head of my bed. We're morning shower people. The button goes next to the alarm clock. You hit the alarm, you snuggle with the boss. When it's time to get out of bed, you press the button. by the time you've gone to the toilet and gotten undressed, hot water's in the bathroom.
And where did the hot water go that the pump brought?
Oh, it went back to the water heater through the cold water line.
Great. So what you're doing is a plumbing connection between the hot and cold line.
That's absolutely correct.
And that's what allows that return.
That's correct.
Okay.
And
it took
the
me a while to figure that
pump.
Out. That's why I'm raising it.
Yeah. The pump has a valve in it that doesn't allow crossover. It's well thought through. The best website to learn more about this is gothotwater.com. All right. Moving on. Hot water circulation system, slide 33. There are six types of research systems. Thermosiphon, continuously pumped, timer-controlled, temperature-controlled, time and temp-controlled, and demand-controlled. Given the same plumbing layout, all these systems will waste the same amount of water at the beginning of each hot water event. The difference is in the energy it takes to keep the trunk line prime with hot water. So, the operation costs of loops, 90% of the cost is from the heat loss in the loop, 10% is from the pump operation, in almost every case. On slide 36, there's a couple of ways you could figure out how much heat loss is in a circulation loop, but it turns out that all you really need to know is the flow rate and the temperature difference, and that will tell you what you need to know in terms of energy. Slide 37 shows you how to calculate it. Slide 38 and 39 show you the impact. Let's go to slide 38. Under the assumption you have a pump moving 24/7 at 1 gallon per minute with a 1 degree temperature drop, you will spend 58 therms a year keeping the water in the loop warm. If you have a 5 degree temperature drop, the number goes up to over 290 therms a year. If you have a 20-degree temperature drop, and some do, you get over 1,200 therms a year. Well, let's assume that we've got a 5-degree temperature drop, which is plausible and reasonable for the applications in single-family residential that we're likely to have and see. What I would say is, then, at 1 gallon a minute, 5 degrees temperature drop, you've doubled the cost of water heating. So, Linda, you were telling me about one of your friends who tried to do this 1,000-home challenge thing, and their water heating bill was exorbitant. Well, here's a good reason. Basically, they put in a research system and ran it too many hours.
And a frame of reference, for a household, three-person household in Northern California, moderate warm climate, 43 therms would be your total hot water allowance. And what Gary's saying is you could blow 292 gallons without or 292 therms without even dealing with the hot water energy. You're just dealing with a wasted energy here.
That's
right?
Correct. That's absolutely correct.
So continuous pumping
research
is not an option
doesn't make
unless you've got PV and solar hot water galore.
Well, I would just say it's not an option at all. It's inelegant from an energy point of view. It's silly. By the way, it tends to ruin your pipes, so it's a pretty bad thing. Oh, by the way, we didn't count the energy to run the pump. That's additional. And in this application, it's somewhere around $50 a year. All right, let's go to slide 39. Same temperature conditions, but I'm heating water electrically over 6,000 kilowatt hours a year. That's 10 times the energy of a typical refrigerator. This is just to keep the loop warm so you have instantaneous hot water. All right, a couple of interesting points. Some folks think that tankless water heaters are instantaneous. Well, they're not. But one of the solutions to not being instantaneous that the manufacturers recommend in their literature is to add a small buffer tank, an electrically heated buffer tank, between the tankless and the fixtures, and you keep that tank hot electrically. And then if you want to deliver hot water more instantaneously, they recommend putting in a recirculation loop, often a 24/7 loop. Okay, great idea, except for a couple of points. Let's imagine you started with 300 therms per year for natural gas at $1 a therm, call it $300. You put in this tankless water heater and you got your bill down to, let's just say, $200 a year. You saved a third. Not a bad guess. It's a pretty reasonable estimate. You might save a bit more. And then in order to get the instantaneousness you wanted, you add in the buffer tank along with the recirc loop. You have now added, at 10 cents a kilowatt hour, over $600 a year to your bill. So you went from 300 down to 200, you added up another 600, you more than doubled, almost tripled, your energy costs for hot water by going tankless. I'm confused. That does not make sense to me. All right? The next point on this is that if you have a timer-based system or a temperature, or temperature meaning aquastat-controlled system, they run fewer hours a day. That's the point of all those controls, and the key is to figure out how to match timer systems or aquastat systems to your demands. It's not easy to do. Hot water use varies dramatically over time, and what we really want to be able to figure out is our patterns change day to day, hour to hour. We want hot water now, we don't. We leave, we're back. Who knows what they are? They vary all over the map. So picking a timer-based system is tough to do. Picking an aquastat-based system means the hot water is going to be hot a lot more hours a day than you might otherwise need it, just in case. The one that matches our patterns the best is on demand, because we all know when we plan to use hot water next. I bet most of us know when we're going to shower next. Some of us will be tonight. Some of us will be tomorrow morning. We know approximately now when it's going to be, but I'm sure we know a minute before. How do we know? We get undressed. We turn on the tap and then get undressed. Turn on the tap, go to the kitchen, make coffee, and then get undressed. I don't know. We have a pattern. If we told the pump to come on shortly before we wanted it and knew we wanted hot water, we would then be able to have hot water delivered on demand from any water heater in any location in our buildings. Slide 40. I've covered much of this, but demand-controlled circulation in residential applications of the types of homes I typically see runs less than a half an hour a day, max. I typically see it running less than 10 minutes a day. And if you're building homes or renovating homes and keeping this concept in mind, you can get the hours of operation to 10 minutes or less per day for infinitely convenient hot water. Whenever you want it, it will show up quickly.
And what would the range of cost be? I know it'd be big difference.
Yeah, the range of costs for hot water demand-controlled circulation currently range from around $300 to over $900. Depends whether you're getting buttons or wireless and wireless motion sensors. Various communication strategies add to the cost. People do this for convenience. The only one that's an energy-efficient strategy is on demand. So for this group on the phone, we want to be energy efficient. That's what we're talking about. And what we're able to determine is that in retrofit applications, it saves water and energy. So what I want you to do is to look at the retrofits section, slides 41 through slides 48. Slide 41 through 46. I'm going to let you all read those after the call. They talk about the pluses and minuses and the benefit streams, and I want to move on to slide 48, please. To improve the use phase, we need to insulate the pipes. We talked very briefly about this yesterday, and I want to spend a minute or two more on it now. For uninsulated pipes in air, and key, air at room temperature, there's approximately a 6 degree Fahrenheit temperature drop. In 100 feet of 3/4 inch pipe at 1 gallon per minute. If you insulate it, the temperature drop over the same distance goes down to 3 degrees Fahrenheit. If you put pipe under slab and do not insulate it, the temperature drop can be 8 times larger than it would be in air. So if it's 6 degrees here, it would be 50 degrees, 48 degrees, over the same distance under a slab, uninsulated pipe in damp sand. That's how we measured it. That's an enormous difference. Do you think it makes sense to insulate buried pipe? Yes. Personally, I don't think we should bury pipe under slabs. And by the way, it's not because of the heat loss, although that's horrible. The big issue is how do you repair them? If you must have an island sink in a kitchen, on a slab on grade construction, and I think that that's a perfectly reasonable thing to desire. Put the pipe that feeds the sink, the island sink, in a conduit, so when it breaks, it can be removed. Think 3-4 inch diameter PVC or ABS drain line without the holes in it. Those kinds of things would be an absolutely perfect way to bring the pipe from the walls under the slab to the island, and make sure it stays insulated as it goes through.
So in a 1,000-home challenge perspective, the good news is that these pipes that have been buried in the slabs for years in California are starting to fail. So isn't that good? Because that means that we can replace what shouldn't exist anyway?
Well, it's great, except if it's an island sink, you're going to have to tear up your floor. Well, if you're going to do that anyway, I guess it's okay. What's really interesting to me is that plumbers always tell me, well, if the stuff breaks under the slab, we'll just abandon it and go overhead. Well, my question is, why didn't we do that in the first place? Makes it easier to repair long-term. And we really do need to think about long-term repair in the buildings we're building. All right, I need to keep moving here. To improve the cool-down phase, slide 49, we need to insulate the pipes. And what we're talking about here is doubling or tripling the cool-down time on half-inch or three-quarter-inch pipe. And we've used R4 insulation. It's roughly, for half-inch pipe, that's roughly a little over a half an inch, not quite three-quarters of an inch. For three-quarter-inch pipe, it's really three-quarters of an inch wall thickness. What I want you to think about is what the temperature drop will be, the time, the doubling time, or the cool-down time. How much will it be for 3/8, 1-inch, and 2-inch pipe? For 3/8 inch pipe, it's probably going to be on the order of 1.5 times the cool-down time in air. For 1-inch pipe, it looks like it's going to be about 4 times as long, and 2-inch pipe, probably at least 4 times as long, maybe significantly longer, likely significantly longer. It tells me that we really ought to think of different strategies for bigger buildings where we have bigger pipes. Rather than 24/7 recirculation, we should be able to pulse them with hot water every so often and make sure that they remain hot. And yes, there is a priority to insulating the pipes. If you have to make a priority, trunks first, branches second, twigs third. But my observation is this: the piping is buried behind the walls and under the floors. Once it's buried, you can't go back to it in the next 80 years in some reasonably cost-effective way to fix it. Insulate it. All right, we're on to some questions that we got. First one was about the status of revising codes for minimum pipe diameters and the current minimums. I already talked about a little bit. The status of revising codes, we are in a code cycle for both the Uniform Plumbing Code and the International Plumbing Code. I'm participating in both, and by the end of this year, I expect we will see some changes in the basic codes. I also work on various green codes like ASHRAE 189.1 and 2 for bigger buildings. I've worked on the NAHB Green Standard nationally, WaterSense for Homes, Build It Green, all of the green sorts of stuff, LEED for Homes, all have things in them related to hot water distribution. Pipe diameters, it's tougher to fix. That's going to be a bit slower. I'm expecting they will be changed by 2015, not by 2012.
So I would think a key thing is, Gary, that you often don't agree with what the revisions are. So if anyone out here, like Mike O'Brien from Portland, is involved in having any influence over local green codes, you'd really want to run things by Gary, because he's great at being able to review quickly or just bring out his draft of what he recommended that maybe was not paid attention to.
Yes, I'd be pleased to help anyone who's trying to do that. Then the home run systems I've already talked about a bit. Long twigs don't perform well. From a hot water point of view, hot and cold need to be insulated when they run close to each other. There should not be bundles of hot water piping. It's absolutely ludicrous. Oh, by the way, PEX is not a better product than copper from a heat point of view. That'll come on the next page. Recirculation, we've talked about that a bit today. The only energy efficient strategy that we have found to date for recirculation by energy efficient, it means it must be better than all other recirc, and it must be better than running water down the drain. That was one of the criteria we gave, is the on-demand pipe, on-demand recirc type. On slide 51, the question about better piping materials, we have tested copper, PEX, and CPVC at half and three-quarter inch diameters. We're working our way through 3/8 and we'll hopefully get up to 1 inch. We have not yet tested stainless, although the stainless that's come onto the market recently with solar is all flex, which means it has greater pressure drop over a given distance than the other materials, which are smoother, do. We've tested these. What we have learned is that uninsulated pipe, copper, PEX, and CPVC, perform very similarly. In fact, new copper outperforms PEX and CPVC. Why? We are pretty sure that it has to do with the radiant effect of the temperature of the water in the pipe, and new copper is a bad radiator. Old copper, when it turns brown, probably is a pretty good radiator. We're in the middle of completing some tests to see if our suspicions are correct. We'll have answers sometime by September, we hope, this year, and they'll be published later this year. How bad is it really to put insulated hot water pipe under a slab? Horrible. Don't do it. And then in existing houses, it may not be practical to implement some structural recommendations such as replacing pipes. How can we prioritize the list of recommendations? What I would say is that the most important thing to do is to figure out what your trunks and branches look like based on that example that we've given you for an exercise. Once you've determined that you've got significant waste on one or more trunks, then I would say the best thing to be doing is to put on-demand pumps on each of the major trunk lines. Certainly start with the worst one, and use it to prime the line with hot water when you want hot water for sure to show up. That will get you hot water quicker, make you happier, make your customers happier, and they will actually have been saving a little bit of energy and a bunch of water. That's the single most important thing to do so far in retrofit. If you have to, certain applications indicate that really long runs, like a 50, 60, 70-foot run to a half bath that's only used three times a year, maybe you want to think about putting in a small water heater electric that under the sink. That's probably a good choice. Insulate the pipes you can get at. When you open up walls, insulate the pipes whenever you open them up. If you think about it and you know where the pipes run, maybe blowing insulation in would be a good application. Whatever you can get at, this is the order to do it. You start with the things that are exterior and work your way to things that are behind the walls. All right, step two. We need to keep moving. We've got 30 minutes and a bunch of slides. Improve the water use efficiency of the hot water outlets. Basically, I want to cover your questions here. What's the relative efficiency of booster heaters and dishwashers and washing machines? Cold water feed only, distance from the main water heater, reduce the temperature of the main water heater. What if I have solar or other preheat? What temperatures do I need to clean the dishes and the clothes? I want to start with the last one. And the other one on this page is related. What's more efficient, hand washing dishes or using a dishwasher? Well, the answer to the very last question is it depends. If you rinse dishes as you use them throughout the day, and you wait a long time for hot water to arrive, and you rinse and clean the dishes with hot water, that intermittent use pattern wastes a lot of water. If instead you wait until the end of the day, everything gathered up for the whole day, get hot water to the sink once, wash the dishes all at one time and be done with it, you'll have wasted less water because of a behavioral change. If you put all the dishes in the dishwasher and you rinse them with hot water before you do and then you run the dishwasher, you're sort of doing the dishes twice. Modern dishwashers, manufacturers are pretty clear. You probably don't need to worry about rinsing them so much, but then I'd wonder about the filters in them clogging up with all the gunk on the plates. Interesting problem. Working up the list, what temperature do I need to clean the dishes or the clothes? Well, an awful lot of us use cold water washing for our clothes. Very little is really done with hot water much anymore. I was really surprised when my mother finally switched. I thought she'd always use hot water. And she changed 20, 30 years ago. She made that decision to switch. That completely surprised me, by the way. I would observe, however, that with dishes, we currently do not have chemicals for use in residential applications that work well at warm temperatures. They typically want to see 140 or more in the dishwasher itself. So many dishwashers for many years now have had a booster heater in them. The more recent versions of dishwashers have a pretty smart booster heater. It knows to wait to run the cycle until the water is hot. I'm not convinced that was true of dishwashers that are 20 years old or older. The switch happened sometime in the last decade, and I don't know the exact time it occurred. So if your dishwasher is far from the water heater, you might want to consider, and you do not have solar, no preheats that are cheap, then you probably want to consider disconnecting it from the hot line and just letting it use the cold water line for the feed and heat the water that's used for washing dishes electrically. That would save all of the energy lost in the distribution piping. It's particularly true if your pipes are under a slab. Because if the pipes are under a slab, the temperature drop under the slab is much, much larger. And even if you follow the manufacturer's recommendation, which, by the way, is in every dishwasher manufacturer's literature, which is turn on the tap at the sink, get hot water to the sink before you start the dishwasher, by the time the second cycle occurs, if the pipes are under a slab, they will be cold. The dishwasher manufacturers have effectively given up on getting hot water to the fixture. They've said Procter & Gamble solved this problem, and Procter & Gamble hasn't done it yet. So, what if I have solar or other preheat? Well, that's an interesting question. That stuff is much less expensive or more efficient in making it, and we'd probably want to use it in our dishwasher, wouldn't we? So, I think it's an interesting question. One of my friends in Spain was describing this to me a couple of years ago, that as they were adding solar in, they wanted to switch. All of their connections are dishwashers on the cold side, and they wanted to switch it to the hot side under the sink so they could use some of the solar heated water. Interesting strategy. All right, let's move on to slide 54. What about using valves at the shower head to control flow rate? On or off during the shower, reduce or increase flow during use, and shower start. If you have a valve at the shower head, and there are many that are out there, and many of us have tried them where you press a button or flip a valve and the flow rate drops to practically nothing while you're soaping up. Okay, so you get rinsed up with the water, you turn it off while you're soaping up, you turn it back on while you're showering, and be done with it. All right, all that's pretty good. You can cut the amount of water used rather dramatically. Some interesting issues. One, if you're in a multifamily apartment building and you have old fixtures, you are probably going to have something called crossover occur behind the valve, because hot and cold are now connected with a much more restrictive opening at the top. The pressure behind the wall could force hot into the cold into the hot, and you could have interesting temperatures come out when you turn on the tap again. That's point one. Point two is, what if you have a tankless water heater and you went from 1.5 gallons per minute on the hot side down to 1/4 gallon per minute on the hot side? I'm pretty sure you just turned the thing off. And when you turn it back on, if you wait long enough, it's going to start its ramp-up cycle again from the very beginning, and you're going to get a slug of not hot water coming through the pipes while you turn it back on again. It's the interactions among the various bright ideas that always concern me. The same happens with reducing or increasing flow during use. Most of us do not have high flow rate shower heads now. Most of the stuff we've got is reasonably low. And so lowering it more, I'm not sure makes a whole lot of sense for many of us. It will help. It'll save some energy and some water, and I agree with the idea of doing it. But I'm not clear of how big the benefit will really be. And again, you could easily reduce the flow rate at some point to be too low for an all tankless water heating option. If the flow goes below 0.5 gallon per minute for sure, virtually none of the most popular gas tankless water heaters will continue to operate. So that's a real interesting problem that needs to be taken into account in the system. Shower Start is an interesting product that's available, and it's out of Arizona. It's a valve that turns off when hot water arrives. So it's part of the delivery phase of a hot water event. When you bring the hot water runs down the drain, as it runs down the drain through the shower valve, when it sees hot water, the valve goes down to a trickle. And then I have to tell you, I've tried it, and what you notice, it's sort of like having a tea kettle whistle at you. You notice the change in sound because instead of the water hitting as a normal shower pattern, it hits with this stream of dripping water because the flow rate is so much lower, and it reminds you it's time to go get in the shower. I think it helps enormously with behavioral waste. But again, a caution, how is it going to work? If you've got old valves that are not protected thermostatically, or you're in a building with lots, in like an apartment building with potential crossover, and the other question is, what will it do if you have a straight tankless gas water heater for operations, for heating the water? It's going to turn it off. One last point about showers, and it's also true about sinks, lavatory faucet sinks. The feel is more important than the flow rate. I get shower heads to try on a pretty regular basis, so I change them out. I test them with my wife and I, my kids, that sort of stuff. They're guinea pigs, I'm sorry, but it's true. And sometimes they're not willing. So last year I got a new shower head to try. The one my wife and I like is what I would call a hard shower. The one that we were trying felt like a much softer shower to me, both at the same flow rate of around 1.5 gallons a minute. Both worked fine. No problems with basic showering and time and all that other stuff. One felt different than the other. So we took the hard one out and put it in the kids' bathroom, which was over 2 gallons per minute of flow, but a much softer feel. My kids got up that morning, went in to take showers. They both took showers, both girls. They came down for breakfast, and they said some version of who the blankety-blank changed the shower head. Well, they looked at me. They knew it was me. I didn't get around to changing it, and we have a third shower in that house, and the next morning they got up and they looked at the shower head in their bathroom and they went downstairs to shower with the old shower. They refused, given an option, to use that new shower head. So we took the hard one out and put it back in our bathroom for my wife and I, and we took the softer one and put it in theirs, and at 1.5 gallons per minute, the kids are happy again. It's the feel that matters, not so much the flow rate. Let's move on to step three, capturing waste heat running down the drain. There's a question on drain water heat recovery. How much benefit does it provide? What are the best applications? Are there any that work horizontally? And does it make sense to insulate? Well, the drain water heat recovery systems, as we discussed the other day, are the vertical ones. Are able to get somewhere around halfway from cold water, raise the temperature of water about halfway, maybe a bit more, from the cold water temperature coming in to the hot water mix temperature at the valve. That's approximately what they're able to do. So that benefit is what you're going to get in reduced hot water flow, either at the valve or at the water heater. That's where you get the benefit stream. And the Canadians have done some interesting testing to show how these devices work in applications in Canadian housing, and there's some really good test reports that are worth reading. What are the best applications? You need a simultaneous use of hot and cold water. Think showers. Think dormitories. Think health clubs. Think teenager showers. Really good applications that make sense to do. Currently, there are none on the market that work horizontally that I have seen. There's some interesting issues with horizontal versions. I know a couple of companies that are working to test them and get rid of some of the problems, but right now the ones that are available on the market that I'm familiar with are all vertical devices. You want the greatest length you can get. If you only have a foot, you're not going to get much benefit. If, on the other hand, you've got a 10-foot rise and you can wrap the tubing around it lots and lots of times, you can capture an enormous amount of the waste heat that's in the water while you're taking a shower. And does it make sense to insulate the outside? You know, it can't hurt, but I've never seen a calculation to figure out how much and what the benefit is. I would observe that if you're going to bury the the drain heat recovery behind a wall, or it's going to be in a cool basement, I'd say insulate it. Step 4, increase water heater efficiency. We're on slide 57, folks. A couple of slides and then the questions. Are you going to have a backup for solar water heating? We covered this the other day. The answer is yes for most of us. How big is it and how small is it? We also covered. And I want to talk mostly about simple solar. It was one of the questions that came up. And I think that what we've got now in solar thermal is a relatively expensive system. We only spend, on average, $300 to $600,000, I don't know, pick a number. With the numbers we're using in our examples, $300 to $600 a year for hot water. Some of us might be close to $1,000 a year for hot water for the average family of three. If your family is two, it's probably less. If it's four, it's probably more. But it's not thousands and thousands of dollars a year. The dilemma we face with our housing stock is that we move. And so if we spend a lot of money on the water heating system because we're a family of six, and then we move out, the family of two that moves in is going to have this enormously oversized solar heating system. And their system is going to have problems because it gets too hot too much of the time. So we have to think about putting in solar, I think, in modules that start smaller and grow or can be removed and reduced over time as things change. That's not the norm for the way we think about systems on our buildings. In my opinion, the best solar water heater I ever saw was shown to me by a fellow who 30 years ago must have been in his 50s, like I am now. Seemed like an old guy. He worked for the gas and electric company in upstate New York where I lived at the time. And he came to one of our classes and showed us his summer project. His summer project was to take a dinged jacket electric water heater, strip off the jacket, strip off the insulation, which in those days was fiberglass and easy to do, paint the remaining tank flat black, stand it up outside his house on the south side of his house, put it underneath a plastic greenhouse, put up with 2x2 framing, tee into the cold water line, headed to the water heater, tee back into the cold water line, put in the appropriate valves, and let the thing get hot when it sat in the sun. Now, we're talking about Ithaca, New York, not known for the sun being the sunniest place in the United States. In that climate, he and his family of four people total got 100% of their hot water from the sun during the summer months in Ithaca. And in the swing seasons, got enough extra heat out of it such that they got over a 50% solar fraction from that water heater. Now, mind you, it wasn't the prettiest thing in the world, but it was really inexpensive. And yes, he turned it off twice a year. Turned it off once, turned it on once to get rid of the freezing problem. That's simple solar. We have to start thinking about preheating water inexpensively every day of the year from the sun if we're going to go to use it. That's what I think about this process, and someone asked, so I'm covering it. Another question came up about the relative efficiency of water heaters and how could gas tankless be efficient in any fashion because of the size of the burner. I'm on slide 59 now, yes. Gas tankless water heaters, the most popular ones, and by that I mean specifically the Rinnais, Takagis, and Noritzes, which are the most popular brands sold in the United States. There's some others, too, of the same basic category and type, meaning they have big burners and really small tanks, as in about a quart in the heat exchanger. That's the type I'm describing. They work great when you have medium flow rates on the order of 2-3 gallons a minute, medium temperature rises, and you're in the sweet spot of their burner. And you want to take long showers? They look great. You want to wash your hands at a half gallon per minute lavvy faucet? They mostly won't turn on. You need 3/4 of a GPM or more to sustain, to start flow, and a half a gallon per minute to sustain it. Well, hands-free faucets in public lavatories, the hot water side is on the order of 1/4 of a gallon per minute. the water heater will never fire. Well, since people didn't expect hot water in the public restroom anyway, no harm, no foul. But the health code said you're supposed to have hot water. You can't get it. It isn't going to be there. So we have to pay attention to the device and its performance over its range of operations that are likely to occur. Low flow rates cause gas tankless water heaters to have fits. High incoming temperatures cause them to have fits. We have to think through how we're going to use the technology in an integrated system. Enough on that point. And the bandwidth that I show here for both gas and electric tankless has to do with the intermittency and smallness or bigness of the hot water flows. The lowest efficiencies are intermittent flows at small quantities in both volume and flow rate and duration. The higher efficiencies are when you have higher flow rates, medium flow rates, and longer duration flows. They both look more efficient under those considerations. All right, question one on page 60. Assuming the goal is high performance over a wide range, how do you select equipment when data on performance under varying load conditions is not available? I want you to back up to the graph on slide 59. The key answer is always to select for low standby losses, meaning all of the things that happen in standby, electrical as well as fuel, and high thermal efficiencies. How high? For the 1,000-home challenge, I think we have to be talking in gas above 90%. We can't afford 45, 50 therms, 60 therms, 100 therms a year in standby losses on gas if we're going to meet the 1,000-home challenge, unless we have some other means of making up the difference. We really want high thermal efficiencies. Well, the only way to get above 100% in thermal efficiency with currently available product is to think about some way of preheating with heat pumps or preheating with solar and then boosting what remains. That's how we would pick equipment. Moving on to slide 61, I think we've covered all of the questions that are here. How do they work with preheat systems is one we haven't really covered well. Well, they don't like really high incoming water temperatures, so the manufacturers require the installation of a tempering valve between the cold water line and the solar storage or any other preheat system with high incoming temperatures so that they can add enough cold water to the mix to make sure that the burner operates properly. And with drain water heat recovery systems, if you take enough heat out of the drain and do not do combined flow or equal flow where you run it back to the water heater, you will actually drop the flow rate at the water heater too low, and all of a sudden it will not operate either. Oh, by the way, it'll be relatively warm water, but probably still in the range of proper operation. If it gets too hot, you're still going to have to add cold water to make it work right. Slide 62, how do you integrate solar, probably thermal, it wasn't clear from the question, into a high-performance system? Standalone water heating. Okay, is it standalone water heating? The answer is it's an expensive system. I've talked about the simple solar. Should you combine it with space conditioning? Absolutely. If you're going to put solar into a high-performance system, we really have to think about the simplest way, the least expensive way we can capture the most heat. That's the strategy we have to be going after because we're going to have a backup system. I really think for the homes we're building with the 1,000-home challenge, we should absolutely be looking at combining with space conditioning, which I'll cover in a minute. Someone asked a question that came through this morning about whether we ought to be looking at solar PV rather than solar thermal and heat pump water heaters. And I think that that's a very interesting question for us to explore over the next year. I think there might be some very interesting sweet spots where we go to solar PV to provide the electricity to run the heat pump, and we do things to improve the performance of the heat pump itself to optimize its sweet spots so that it runs very few kilowatt hours per day to do its job. That would be a really good strategy. combined water heating and space conditioning systems. Someone asked about the Navy and Combi system, if I've seen it. I had not. I went and looked. And what I would say is there's no tank. It's, and what they recommend is they recommend putting the Navy Combi system in and another Navy and water heater in to provide your hot water needs. We're missing the point here, folks. The buildings we're building in the 1,000 Home Challenge, the ones we're renovating in the 1,000 Home Challenge, have very small thermal loads. They need a quarter of what we're used to seeing. So what we have to be doing is to look smaller, not larger. So I'm not happy with the way the Combi system looks at the moment. My apologies for the beeping. Someone's trying to get through on my home line, and they'll have to wait. Should you integrate with solar? Yes, absolutely. Moving on. Heat pump water heaters. Can they replace a dehumidifier? Can they be a heat sink and help air condition? How can we make them operate most efficiently? What are the climate zone considerations? Well, whew, lots of things here. Can they replace a dehumidifier? Possibly. We need to think about how much water needs to be removed, and if we're in a position of reducing the load of moisture by, for example, sealing the crawl space with plastic, that would be the first thing to do to reduce the load on the building. All of a sudden, dehumidification needs drop rather dramatically. I think that in climates that need dehumidification, like the Southeast, we should be thinking about sizing the heat pump so that it is, in fact, the primary, if not sole, dehumidifier. Can they be a heat sink and help air condition? Very interesting question from friends in Canada. A comment on a system that's been around for a while. Absolutely. That turns out to be one of the things that we want to do to improve the operational efficiency of a heat pump. If we can give the integrated heat pumps that are on the market today, heat pump water heaters that are on the market today, a source of warm air, not too hot, but sort of in the, say 70 to 90 degree range, they will work really well. Their efficiency, their coefficient of performance will climb to the 4.5 to 5 range instead of the average of 2 that we currently assume for the DOE energy factor test. If we lower the temperature in the tank from 135 at the DOE test to 125, which is still good to help kill Legionella and things like that, you operate more efficiently again. Climate zone considerations, a little harder to figure out what you should put in where. Will you be taking heat from a house if you put them in a northern climate? The answer is yes. Will it be absolutely detrimental? Probably not. But it does need to be mathematically calculated, and there are folks working on that. I do not have formal answers as of today. We need to keep moving. We've only got about 5 more minutes. Are there tankless electric water heaters that play well with preheat solar? Yes. Look at Sysco. I know they've been working with preheat solar systems for at least the last half dozen years. Seisco.com. There may be others. More questions on 64. Does the preheat and boost strategy increase the growth rate of Legionella? Legionella grows really well between about 90 degrees and 115, 120 degrees. After that, it starts to die relatively quickly. Over 140, it dies really fast. But you don't want it too hot because you were worried about burning people. You want to keep the temperatures probably around 125. Legionella comes in the cold water. Either you've got it or you don't. Very interesting set of problems. I don't have time right now to go into more detail on it.
So it'd be coming in from the water system, you mean?
Like yes, coming in with the cold water system. Right. Yes, that's correct, Linda. It just comes in. So, is it going to grow significantly to cause harm? For most of us, not. It's an interesting question, and I know that folks are working on studying this to figure out what's going on. The CDC is paying a lot of attention to it. I don't have all the answers.
So stay tuned is your answer.
I'm sorry?
Stay tuned is your answer.
Yes. Ground source heat pumps using a superheater, that's the summertime mode or the swing season mode when you've got air conditioning running. Yes, you should use it if it's available. Otherwise, if you're using ground source heat pumps, they have to figure out how you're going to heat the water. Using the heat pump side to heat the water is always the right strategy. It's more energy efficient than heating it straight electric. And what about desuperheaters off of an AC system? There's energy to be captured there, folks, and it's worth looking at as to how to capture the heat and use it as a preheat strategy. I've seen a lot of this in Florida for pools. Page 65, if I have a gas and high-efficiency boiler, should I use small well-insulated boiler mate with large-diameter pipe for fast recharge, sort of like tank and tankless, isn't it? The answer is yes, and you should. Solar thermal, I do not have any obvious recommendations for inexpensive meters and monitoring. I'm familiar with the ISTA BTU meters from 30 years ago when I first got started. They're not cheap, but they work. If you've got the ability to measure temperature and flow, you can do that much less expensively with hobo technology than you can with ISTA's technology. But it's certainly worth looking at, and we're looking for better packages. Summary, slide 66. We've got a few more minutes. A couple more questions. How do I disaggregate hot water from my energy bills? Well, gas is easy. Electric is a little bit more difficult, and propane is still more difficult. If you've got gas for your water heating, you probably only have three or four things that run on gas in your home. Well, the summer months, most of us are cooking, washing our clothes, and maybe have a gas dryer, and we're heating water. Wintertime is when we turn on the gas furnace, and probably the gas fireplace if we have one of those. Well, I would observe that most of us don't spend a whole lot of time and money cooking these days. It's gone way down from when I was a child. So the in-home cooking has gone way down. The amount of energy attached to cooking is relatively small. If all you've got is cooking and water heating in your summer bills, it's a pretty good estimate that 80% or more will be water heating. If you've got dryers, make it 75% or more. It's to get you close. That's how I would do it. If you really want to figure out how much water you've got, measure the temperatures of incoming water and outgoing water, and then do the mathematics to figure out how much energy that works out to be, and that'll give you a pretty good estimate of gallons per day or gallons per year, however you do your math.
Gary, I'm going to jump in and just say let's buy 5 minutes. And okay. We'll close at 1:35, and if some of you need to go first,
go for it.
But that way at least Gary can cover these last couple questions without quite as much stress.
I don't have stress. All right. How low can we go? Let's go back up to the disaggregation. Electric, you've got much more stuff going on, and so you actually have to do a bit more to really get at your hot water numbers. Water heating is on the order, it's 10 times as big as your, it's on the order of 10 times as big as your refrigerator. So that's a good way to look at it. If I were doing it, I would actually figure out how to measure flow rate and delta T and then do the mathematics accordingly. Propane, same way, good luck. You get built, you buy propane 2-3 times a year. It's a real problem to disaggregate. You need to go at the end use level. Back to the electric model, electric energy side, you might be able to use one of the TEDs or something like that to figure out what's going on for water heating all by itself if you put one of them in.
Another option wouldn't it be to just turn off either your gas or electric hot water heater for a day as a test or occasional couple days just to sort of see how it compares. You'd obviously have to consider the warm-up phase, but you still could get some sense from that, I would think, if you're doing daily meter reads.
Yeah, you could do it. That's a good way, Linda. How low can you go? Well, with efficiency, I'm pretty sure from everything we've worked on is that it's straightforward to figure out how to reduce the wastes in the system by 25 to 50% and effectively reduce the energy needed for heating water by on the order of 50%. That's what we can do easily with conservation and reducing the wastes. If we improve the efficiency of our water heaters, we can cut that number in half again without much trouble. And if we're able to use heat pump water heaters and we've done it right, we might be able to take that number down to about 10% of where we're at now in terms of real energy. That's an enormous improvement in efficiency and gets us right in the range we need to be for the 1,000 Home Challenge. If we're not able to go all of those steps, then with changes in behavior, we should be able to hit that 10% number too. That's a huge win. It's much bigger than anyone would have guessed. I don't think very many of us are pushing that hard yet. We haven't been putting everything into place in one building and testing it to figure out what's really happened yet. The sooner we do that for some applications, the better off we'll be.
And I'd like to just throw in, LBNL is monitoring a number of NorCal deep energy retrofit projects, and certainly a major idea of the 1,000 Home Challenge is that it's a great opportunity to learn. Those folks that are participating can really contribute. Ideally, other folks will be able to benefit from what we learn as we, what works, what the most strategic opportunities are, and it's not whether or not you meet the challenge as much as what, you know, how we learn from the process, getting as good feedback as we can, and certainly looking at system performance, not just individual performance. So the 1,000 Home Challenge can really, I think, contribute to a lot of gain in knowledge regarding the boundaries as far as how far we can go, how low we can go. And the idea is absolutely to share that information. One aspect of the 1,000 Home Challenge is that absolutely we're embracing staged approaches, which would be not doing everything at once, you know, in a house, but basically saying, okay, I'm going to do this year, this and this next year. And in many cases, the building envelope stuff's most expensive. So a household that decided to take on the electricity and the hot water could conceivably have a staged process where they sort of take bites at smaller bites at a time, get valuable information, and then feed that into the rest of the strategy. So obviously you can learn a whole lot if somebody is only changing one element at a time, even though you might not get all the synergies either. So just wanted to throw that in before you move on, Gary.
Thank you. On slide 68, what are the best, most accurate sources of information about residential water heating systems? There's some good stuff in Canada. There's some good stuff at LBNL. There's some good stuff at Florida Solar. I would say the best compilation of stuff is the most recent, the last 3 years of hot water forums sponsored by ACEEE. It's a collaboration of over 150 people getting together for each of the last 3 years, talking with each other about what's current and happening in solar in water heating systems around the country.
And those presentations are on ACEEE's website, and if you go to those presentations, you'd also get the email address of different presenters, so you could track down the Canadians that then LBNL and the other folks that Gary was referring to.
And then finally, what are the biggest ahas that I've had that have changed my perceptions of the opportunities for improving hot water systems? The biggest aha, the first one, was that the waste in the distribution system was way bigger than anyone would have estimated. That goes back almost 20 years now. That's what got me started. The next big aha was that the volume of water, when we defined the problem in terms of volume until hot, how do you get one cup, the challenge we issued before, that got us answers that started to make sense and helped codify what the solutions needed to be. And then the next biggest one was that over the last decade, water heating has overtaken space heating as the biggest thermal load in an awful lot of buildings, an awful lot of our housing all over the United States. All over Canada too. It's growing. We've done an enormous amount to fix our buildings, and we're on a path to making the shell a better shell, and therefore the need for space conditioning has gone down, and certainly the need for space heating has gone down. Well, in an awful large part of the country, water heating is bigger in both total, and it's always bigger in peak. for almost every new building and almost every renovated building we're talking about for housing. And so we should be looking at hot water as the primary need for heat, not space heating. And that's the most recent big aha I've had. And we have to look at combining systems to make that work. Linda, it's yours. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It did occur to me just now that once we go through a few of the sort of closing announcements, we could just unmute and let folks ask any additional questions they have if you have time to stick around. I don't know if you want to do that, Gary. We didn't discuss that ahead of time.
I have 10 more minutes. I have another appointment that's 2 hours away, so okay. I need to move.
Okay, let's not do that and think about a follow-up. Folks can send me email. Certainly the possibility of a follow-up conversation, and also we've been considering the idea of a blog where we'll be posting some of these pieces like recirc or combi systems or heat pump water heaters, and people could not only ask questions but obviously offer comments and perspective, which is obviously a high value. So a couple announcements. Thousand Home Challenge website's listed on slide 69, and there are, as I said, two webinars coming up. Send me an email if you're interested in either one of those. Do stay tuned for our next upcoming ACI events going on in pretty much all over. We got Utah, Colorado, Northeast, Northwest, as well as our annual conference is going to be in San Francisco next year, and then a Southern California event coming up in the late winter. If you haven't already checked out the resources that we've got posted, Gary graciously gave us a bunch of stuff that we could put under a resources tab on the Thousand Home Challenge website. We'd also be interested in perhaps entertaining links to others, maybe in just put a PDF with links to others. So if you know of reports and valuable resources, we could just put a document that would be available for downloading, and that would be a way of adding to this conversation and exchange. On slide 71, I wanted to point out that PG&E has a number of classes. I don't even know how many they do. I think it's up to more than 100 free classes, half and full day classes in Northern California. They scatter them all over the northern part of the state, so check these out. And Gary's doing three that are scheduled so far. So with that, our next webinar, last slide, 72, is analyzing electric use, a critical step towards deep reductions, and that will be August 10th. Feel free to forward the information we sent you to others that you might think are interested. We have an awful lot of the people who registered that are on this call are also registered for that one. So we look forward to you joining us at that time. So thank you very much, and do send feedback by email. And thank you so much, Gary, for your time in preparing and presenting these two webinars. And just want to again acknowledge our appreciation to PG&E's Energy Training Center for sponsoring this series and the time that it takes to put this together. We certainly welcome sponsorship from others who might want to have a webinar series focused to their particular climate as well. So thank you. Look forward to hearing from you and having you on a future webinar. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.